One. So what do we do with the children of terrorist families? Good question, right? Hi, this is Phil Gursky, President and CEO of Borealis Threat and Risk Consulting. Listen to Canadian Intelligence, eh? I've talked a lot about terrorism over the last couple of years. I'm kind of getting tired of talking about terrorism. And I think for most people in the West, not a lot of sympathy for terrorists. Unless, of course, you're Palestinian, but that's a whole other podcast these days. You know, men and women who deliberately join terrorist groups, we don't feel sorry for them. We feel they should be charged under our criminal codes and, you know, brought to trial. And if necessary, enough evidence, then set to find them guilty and sentence them. But it's another story for children, because children don't make conscious decisions to join terrorist groups, at least not to the best of my knowledge. This has come to a head lately, especially with Islamic State or ISIS. Of course, the Islamic State was created back in 2014, and upwards of somewhere between 30 and 40,000 people from over 100 nations left to go join the so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria, and some of them brought their kids with them, or had kids while they were there between 2014 and 2019. And we're now left with a conundrum of a bunch of children languishing in camps like Al-Hol in Syria, and what to do with them. The adults, I have no problem with trying the adults, but you can't try kids for terrorism. So this has become a real problem for countries in the West about the fate of the children. And so to talk about this, I brought in somebody who knows a heck of a lot more about children and terrorism than I do. Dr. Lynn Schneider. She's a research fellow at the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague. I was with the ICCT in The Hague back in 2016. She's been doing some research funded by the German Federal Office for Migration and Refugees. And she's trying to understand the long-term development of ISIS-affiliated child returnees. And some of her previous research looked at children in both Islamist and right-wing extremist families. Lynn is joining me from The Hague, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
What was it in the first place that got you interested in children as a topic of study?
Well, I have a background in child development, and I actually worked in foster care settings and in orphanages in Germany and in the West Bank before. So children were always of interest to me. I moved on to do degrees in education policy development and so on, and then quickly moved to the role of education in countering violent extremism. And then Dr. Joanna Cook from Leiden University brought to life this really amazing project, the PREPARE project, trying to find out how the life of children is affected if their parents are involved in violent extremist or terrorist organizations. So I started working on this project as a researcher, and now my current project, funded by the German government, is a sort of follow-up to this, trying to fill the gaps and pieces that we weren't able to cover. So, yeah.
Right. It is a field that's not, I don't recall a lot of research being done in this regard. And certainly from my perspective as former intelligence, you know, we didn't target children. We didn't investigate children. Some of your research looked at the far right, and we all know that, you know, the far right is of concern, especially in Germany these days, I would say, to a lesser extent here in Canada. What did your research into the far right in Germany show in terms of what the children were being exposed to? And what the effects of being linked in families to right-wing supporters, what kind of effects was that having on child development?
So that's a good question. I think, first of all, it's really important to emphasize that families are very diverse. So there's not this one type of extremist right. family. So what children experience there can be very unique. And also when we talk about children in violent extremist or terrorism affiliated families, everybody wants to know how indoctrinated are they. And they just assume that there's this causal relationship between having an extremist parent and being ideologically indoctrinated yourself. There are some studies that show, for example, about white supremacists in the US, that they actively try to hide their neo-Nazi identity from their children.
Oh, really?
So we cannot necessarily assume that all right-wing extremist parents also try to indoctrinate their children. That being said, I also did some research on somewhat cult-like groups like the Völkische Siedler in Germany. They live in rural areas there, and they try to really establish their own very closed-off communities. And there we could see that ideological transmission is much more prevalent. So yeah, we found that some of the children living in such environments are raised in accordance with a lot of norms that were also quite prevalent in Nazi Germany in the Third Reich.
Okay.
They still, for example, sometimes use child-rearing guidebooks from the Nazi era.
No way. Really?
Yes. So, these guidebooks basically promote practices that can be quite harmful for children. So they advise parents to deprive their children of love and affection, not to spoil them.
Wow. So
a lot of the very young children spent their first years basically quite isolated from their parents. And when they get older, obedience is the primary goal. So that becomes a bit more important or much more important than their individual needs. So that means parents who follow these guidelines are still extremely authoritarian and punitive. And we've even had cases where neighbors reported that children were being starved as punishment. And that's all part of this idea of toughening them up. So basically they can prepare them to become soldiers in the fight against the decline of their German culture. And that's
wow.
not a new thing. So there are sociologists like Katharina Rutschke termed these practices in German schwarze Pädagogik.
Mm-hmm.
And that translates best into dark or poisonous pedagogy.
Yeah.
And that was really prevalent back in the days. But
The first question I have, Lynn, is if these children are being starved, I mean, you know, we all have our own parenting skills. And, you know, as long as you're not actually physically or emotionally harming your child. I don't know what the laws are like in Europe and in Canada. We have child protection services. If children are in danger, they're being beaten by their parents or whatever, or sexually abused, the state can remove the child from the family. I would assume that in Germany, if somebody is raising their child in a neo-Nazi household and engaged in such practices as, I don't know if beatings are part of your research, but certainly near starvation, do the authorities not have the authority, no pun intended, of removing the child from the family?
Well, I think that's a very complicated thing, yes. I mean, obviously, the German state has authority to remove children from families if there is a concern or proven child endangerment. Often that's really difficult to prove.
It is, yeah.
And it also doesn't always happen. So having an extremist ideology, a violent extremist ideology, or even being a, you know, violent extremist, that is not grounds enough to assume that there is an endangerment of the well-being of the child. So you would have to prove that the ideology actually leads to a certain behavior that then endangers the child, but also keeping in mind that not every child whose well-being has been endangered in a family is immediately being taken away from the families. And I personally think that there is a bit too much of a focus on the separation from children out of these families. Because, I mean, I worked in a clearinghouse for children who were taken away from their families on the grounds of child endangerment. And I absolutely support the separation if there's abuse and neglect. But that separation also comes with its own set of very big problems and traumas. So it's really important to consider what the best interest of the child is. And removing them isn't always in the best interest.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I'm going to return to that question in a second, then. But first, I want to ask you, did you find any similarities or differences in your research when it came to the children in right-wing, neo-Nazi, white supremacist families versus children being raised in Islamist extremist families, such as ISIS? Did you find there were similar patterns or were there distinctions as well?
I think there were quite some surprising similarities. Without wanting to generalize, again, we didn't do quantitative studies of all the factors and experiences. But the insights we got suggest that they're structurally, even though the ideology is obviously quite different, that there can be some similarities. The authoritarian upbringing that we talked about, for example, instrumentalized upbringing. So children are expected in those families who really are interested in this intergenerational transmission. At least children are raised with the idea of assuming a place within this whole ideological fabric. We can also see cases where children were exposed to some kind of alternative education. In Germany, for example, schooling is public schooling is mandatory, so you can't homeschool children. But often these children would then at home receive some kind of alternative curriculums, or parents are trying to evade actually enrolling their children in school, or try to prevent them from attending certain classes. So we've seen that in all kinds of, across the ideological spectrum, basically.
Okay.
Or that parents are trying to shield their children from any kind of exposure to democratically oriented communities and peers.
Sorry, did I hear you correctly? In Germany, homeschooling is not allowed? Because it certainly is allowed in Canada under certain circumstances.
So it's not allowed in Germany. Obviously, with COVID, there was a bit of an exception. But in general, you can't homeschool your child in Germany.
Okay. Now, one of the things, you know, getting back to Islamic State, ISIS, one of the things that we know, because ISIS was very insistent on putting out their propaganda when the so-called caliphate was at its height, is that they were creating the next generation of jihadis, the next generation of terrorists. And they called them lion cubs of the caliphate, and they would show videos and things like that. I remember even seeing a video of a young boy, I think he was 5 or 6, being brought up in an ISIS family in Iraq and Syria. And this boy was, you know, in a lot of trouble because he had such violent tendencies that were being encouraged by his parents because, you know, they wanted him to grow up and be a good jihadi like mom and dad were. So we in the West, and I think Germany is also a case of this. I've talked to Sophia Kohler a lot about this in terms of women returnees from ISIS. We struggle with what to do in this scenario. Some countries like France don't want anything to do with returnees. Others are taking anybody back. Canada seems to be somewhere in the middle here. But a lot of us, you know, myself included, seem to assume, and rightly or wrongly, that maybe we shouldn't allow these parents to maintain custody of their children because, in fact, they do hold to terrorist ideologies and may, in fact, be passing those ideologies on through radicalizing their own children kind of thing. You're saying it's much more complicated than that. So I'm guessing that your research would show that it really is by a case-by-case basis to determine if, in fact, the child should be placed with extended family or where there are no extended family in the care of the state. Is that the kind of solution that your research and your own personal views would hold there?
Yeah, so I definitely think, I mean, as you rightly said, the role of women in ISIS was really complex, right? So we have the very active ones who really subscribe to the ideology and so on. And then we had younger ones who were groomed or even tricked into going there. It's really hard to prove sometimes, right? So without that, we can't even make any call. What we found and what I'm more and more learning in my current project is that sometimes the separation from these children and their mothers upon return inflicted a bigger trauma in these children than their entire experience of living in Syria or Iraq.
Wow.
So regardless of what their mothers have done, there can be made a case that for some of these children, the separation might not be in the best interest. Obviously, again, case by case, if the mother is imprisoned, there would be a separation. We also found that in Sweden and Denmark, for example, many of the children who were repatriated from the detention camps were physically and mentally surprisingly in a good condition. And that could actually be an argument or a testimony for the mother's ability to actually care for them, even in horrendous environments. So I think there are a lot of things to unpack, how extremist the mothers were, how much did they expose their children to ideology and to harm during their time in Syria, what are their abilities to take care of the children back at home. But by default, just removing them, I think, can be a very damaging thing for these children.
I think most of us would assume that in the best case scenario, the best situation for a child is with his or her parents, except in circumstances like serious, you know, physical, sexual, emotional, or mental abuse. I think the problem, I guess, Lynn, is that it would only take one case of a child, you know, who returns, let's say, as a 12 or 13-year-old and seems to be, you know, functioning as normal as one can, having returned to the West from the so-called caliphate, or having been taken from a neo-Nazi family where they've had the indoctrination. And then 3 or 4 years later, that child, you know, takes part in an act of terrorism back home, Germany, Canada, Sweden, Denmark, whatever kind of thing. Then you're going to have this immediate backlash. Well, why was the child allowed to stay in the family in the first place? So, I mean, what would your research say, or your own sort of your own perspective on that? I'm not saying that's a good way of looking at things. It's just, it's the way people are going to react. If something, you know, they want to blame somebody for something happening. And so if a child does grow up to do something horrific and kill people, they're going to demand that the state take further action. So what would be your response to that?
Well, I mean, we come across this idea of children, child returnees being ticking time bombs quite a lot, right? So they've been securitized a lot. I would be careful to assume a direct, a causal transmission of violent extremist ideology from mothers to children in the first place. And then I would also say not everyone who holds a violent extremist views actually become violent extremists or terrorists, right?
You're right, absolutely right, yeah.
Quite a big leap to assume that because a child in early childhood has been exposed to multiple adversities, among them also ideological exposure, that renders them much more vulnerable to actually become a terrorist than a lot of other children in vulnerable settings, right? Everybody is very much focused on the ideological indoctrination. But then, for example, when looking at the podcast from Josh Baker, I'm Not a Monster, there was a child who appeared in an ISIS propaganda video threatening Donald Trump, right? And he got a chance to speak out on this and said, look, you know, a lot of us didn't want to do that and we were forced. So even trying to assess how much real indoctrination happened even among these child soldiers would be important. We can't assume that every child of a foreign fighter or a foreign family traveling to Syria who even had this child soldier training became successfully indoctrinated. And then also thinking about the fact that the whole caps of the caliphate training happened at the time where ISIS was still in charge with children 8 or 9 years old and older. So these children are not the very young children that constitute the majority of kids that are being repatriated from Al-Hol and Rosh currently. So I think there's a bit of a different demography going on here.
No, you raise a good point. And, you know, when you talk about radicalization and indoctrination, we know as security services, the vast majority of people who adopt ideologies never act on them because they're incapable or they're stupid or they're incompetent or they don't really buy into the program. The challenge, though, I would submit to you, Lynn, is that, if you know, you talk about securitization, and I understand that concept. The challenge is if you're working for a security service like CSIS or the BFV or the SEPO in Sweden or PET in Denmark, is that it's really hard to justify investigating a child. Generally speaking, you try to only look at people who are age of majority, which is generally 18, 19 years old, whatever country you live in. And yet people would say, well, you kind of got to keep an eye on these people, even if they're 15, 16 years old, which we would classify as young offenders under the Canadian Criminal Code. I don't know what German Criminal Code is like. But that really causes problems for security services because it kind of straddles that line between, well, there's a potential danger there. It's not, there's no causation. It could be some correlation, but not necessarily causation. And yet, you know, if we don't look at them and something happens, people start pointing fingers. So your security services are actually between a rock and a hard place. They don't want to be investigating children. But if a child ends up doing something, and we've had several cases here in Canada, well, look what just happened in Sydney, where a 15-year-old, you know, stabbed a bishop at a church, and a Syrian Orthodox bishop. I don't know what's they've charged him with terrorism. I don't know what kind of terrorism. I'm guessing it's jihadi, but they're not saying that in the press. So, I mean, I guess my question would be to you, you know, this is a difficult decision to make for your security services and law enforcement, whose mandate it is to try to stop bad things from happening, and yet you don't want to overemphasize children, because under the Canadian Criminal Code, you know, if you commit a crime as a child, once you become an adult, your records are sealed and you're allowed to live your life as an adult, unless it's a very serious crime like murder. So, I mean, do you have any suggestions on how to manage that kind of, I guess, risk assessment when it comes to children?
Well, I think so. What I'm currently trying to do in my project is to really assess how children are developing after they return from Syria and Iraq. We do know, and saying that we don't want to securitize them doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a focus on the development of these children.
Right.
The children who have experienced displacement, the loss of parents, siblings, quite some horrible things. So having a look out for them in general, I think would be quite important, right, to ensure their well-being. But because there is a lot of fear that they're being taken away from the families and so on, I can imagine that this actually alienates parents to reach out for support if they find problems. If a child like that goes to a family, to grandparents, you know, and they don't have trust in actually getting the support that they need, they will probably be less likely to reach out if they realize that the child is developing problems as a teenager. So we're trying to find out not only how do these children actually develop in the long run, but we also would like to find out what are the conditions under which these families, these relatives would actually engage with support and would collaborate more to make sure that they're not being radically exploited, that they're not going down any path that we don't want them to go down. So in a way, focusing on the well-being of these children and on positive relationships further down the line can also foster security. But I still think that in these cases, the most important thing is a focus on the well-being of these children.
Well, and I don't think any of us disagree on that. I mean, you know, we do want to give these children every chance to grow up to be normal adults, despite the fact of their horrendous, in some cases, you know, childhood, whether it's with the far right or with Islamist extremism. Lynn, I really commend you and your colleagues for doing this kind of research. I think it's really important. I think there really is a gap in the literature when it comes to this. And so I want to thank you for, you know, what you're doing. I wish you all the best in continuing your research on this topic. And more importantly, I want to thank you for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That was my conversation with Lynn Schneider, who's a research fellow at the ICCT in The Hague, focusing on children and terrorism. So what do you think about this conundrum, what to do with the children of ISIS returnees or neo-Nazis, white supremacists? Love to hear your feedback. You can reach me on email, borealisrisk@gmail.com, or on X at borealisaves. You'll also find me on LinkedIn and on Facebook. If you like the content and want to get more, go to the website, borealisthreatandrisk.com. Hit the subscribe button. There's no charge. Get access to all the podcasts and blogs. We'll talk again soon. Love to hear your feedback on what you thought of this and other podcasts, perhaps some ideas for future topics. We'll talk again soon. Until then, take care.